Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 15 of the Misfit Faith podcast. I am your host, Jason Stellman. Today was one of the most beautiful days we've had all year. It was about, I don't know, a balmy 57, 58 degrees here in the Seattle area. And I sat on my deck, I read, I had a cigar, I took a walk. I listened to this killer Bob Dylan playlist that I made today that I'm going to play a song at the end of the show from. I heard it in a movie I watched. I just finished watching this film called The Vanishing of Sidney Hall, which stars Logan Lerman, who's the kid from The Perks of Being a Wallflower, and Kyle Chandler is in it as well. He played Coach Eric Taylor on Friday Night Lights. I'm a bit of a sucker for teen drama. That's a topic for another time. He was also the FBI agent in Wolf of Wall Street. And it's a movie about this novelist who becomes this kind of withdrawn, almost hermit-like misanthrope. And if you know me, you know that I'm a sucker for any film involving a tortured writer. But it was hard to feel too tortured today on a day as beautiful as this. But now the sun's gone down and it's nighttime outside and I'm sitting here in my office talking to you people. All right, I have a big announcement. So heads up, pay attention, write this down. The Misfit Faith community that I've been talking about ever since we began this show will be officially launching at the end of the first week of April. Okay, I've been talking to you about how we're going to start this online community. There'll be a private group on Facebook where we will have talks, seminars, lectures, Q&A, discussion, all kinds of things like that. And I'm going to start this officially on Saturday, April 7th. Okay, so the week leading up to that, I'm going to start adding all who are interested in being a part of this community to this private group on Facebook called the Misfit Faith Community. And here's how it's going to work. If you are a patron of $25, so if you go to patreon.com/Jason Stellman and you sign up to be a patron to the tune of $25 per month, then you will have access to this community. I'll add you personally to this group. And every Saturday afternoon, I am going to give a live talk in the group with Q&A afterwards and probably throughout as well. And the page, of course, is going to be live all week. And so anyone who is added to that page can interact, can chat with me, can ask questions, can get to know other people who are going through similar spiritual struggles or a similar spiritual journey as you. But every Saturday, probably around, I don't know, 1 o'clock or so, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there will be a live discussion, a live talk by me followed with Q&A and all of that. Of course, those talks will be archived in the group as well. So if you're not able to participate live, the video will be there for you whenever you want to watch it. And as long as you are a patron of $25, then you will have access to that. And so I'm going to hopefully put out a video on Facebook maybe Monday, you know, kind of giving you a little tour of my study here at home and talking a bit about this. And so keep your eyes peeled for that. The first book that we're going to study together will be Misfit Faith, my own book that came out a year ago. And so we'll probably spend 6 weeks, because there are six chapters, talking about the themes in the book and taking questions and answers and all of that throughout. Also, keep in mind, if you refer someone to the Misfit Faith community and they sign up, then you get a free month. Okay. And so if you're kind of thinking, gosh, $25, you know, if you add up your what you pay for Netflix and what you spend at Starbucks and what you pay for Hulu or HBO or all these other kinds of services, and you think, I don't know if I can swing it, that's a lot of money. Well, if you refer someone who signs up, then you get a free month. If you refer 10 people who sign up, you get 10 free months, okay? And so keep that in mind. I've gotten about, 25 or so people who have filled out the contact form on jasonstellman.com/membership. And I know there are others who are just waiting for this thing to launch. And so I'm excited about this. So keep your eyes peeled for more information here and on Facebook in the coming weeks and even days. Patreon.com/Jason Stellman is where you can become a patron of this show and support the work that I do. I wanted to thank Seth and Earl, who have become patrons in the last week. Although, I do have to say, overall pledges are down, even though I've picked up a couple new patrons. I've lost a couple as well, and I think I'm at a net loss at the moment. But nevertheless, I'm very thankful to all of you who are supporting this show, and especially Seth and Earl this week. And by the way, Earl is a new mentoring client of mine. And the only reason I'm mentioning him by name is because he left a little plug for my mentoring ministry, business, whatever you want to call it, on Facebook. And this is what he said. Just want to plug a minute Jason's mentoring program. I've committed to do this for his next cycle, and we had our first session on Friday, which was yesterday. Very cathartic to verbally express my crisis of faith, having grown up evangelical and now realizing many of the core tenets do not align with my beliefs today. Looking forward to deconstructing my faith and rebuilding with Jason as a sounding board, as someone who's gone through and is still on this journey. And so thanks for that, Earl. And to the rest of you, once we launch the community, I'm going to keep my mentoring clients to 5 and no more. And so if you're interested in that, go to jasonstellman.com/mentoring and let me know. Lastly, number here is 949-354-2483. If you got a question, pushback, feedback, ideas, something you want to rant about, whatever, 949-354-2483, leave me a voicemail and I'll play it on the show. All right. Enough is enough. Let's get on with it. As you know, we started last week a series on the Bible called Thoughts on the Good Book. And as I've said, we're going to talk about some issues regarding Scripture. If you are either an evangelical or probably a post-evangelical, then you're probably trying to navigate, you know, how do I think about the Bible? How do I understand my relationship to this book that at one time I thought about in a certain way, but no, I don't know if I can still think about it in that way anymore. We're going to talk about stuff like canon. You know, how do we know that the table of contents at the beginning of the Bible is correct? Especially, you know, if you're a Protestant, then obviously no one except the Bible is able to speak with divine authority. But if the table of contents is not part of the Bible, then how do you even know you got the right books? We talked a little bit last week about divine violence, and we're going to talk a little bit more about it in this episode. We had Brad Jersak on the show last week, and he wrote a great book called A More Christ-Like God, in which he unpacks his thesis that God is exactly like Jesus. His thesis, Jesus as considered upon the cross, giving of himself, emptying of himself, sacrificing himself. Therefore, you know, you read some of these accounts in the Old Testament, and you think to yourself, God, would Jesus have done that? You know, like the story, for example, of Elisha the prophet in, I think it's 2 Kings 4, I'm not sure, but he's cruising around and these kids start making fun of him because he's bald. You know, and they're like, hey, Baldy. And Elijah curses them and prays that God would smite them, and two bears come out of nowhere and maul 42 of these kids, right? So you think about that and you go, all right, can I imagine Jesus having done that? I mean, would Jesus, the guy who like did not open his mouth when he was being reviled, who refused to defend himself, who stood as a sheep before his shears and was silent, you know, could I imagine Jesus having done that, you know, called God's curse down upon some children, you know, the kind of children that Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like, right? No, I can't imagine Jesus having done that. Or you know, one of my favorite stories, the story of Samson. In the Old Testament, when Samson comes up with this riddle, it's a total kind of bullshit riddle about a lion that died and these bees made a hive in its carcass or whatever, and he dipped his finger in and ate some. And he came up with some lame-ass riddle, and he tells these guys, and I'm butchering the story, all right? It's been a while. But he tells these guys, hey, here's this riddle. Out of the eater came something to eat. Out of the whatever came something sweet. What is it? And if you can guess it, I'll give you all 30 changes of clothing, 30 new pieces of raiment, right? Clothing. And these 30 guys coax Samson's wife Delilah into telling them the answer. She coaxes it out of him. She tells them. They come to Samson and say, hey, we know the answer to your riddle. It's a dead lion or whatever. And instead of just ponying up the agreed upon price because they won, right? They won the bet, right? Instead, Samson goes out and according to the scriptures, with the help of the Holy Spirit, empowered by the Holy Spirit, he murders 30 other guys and then takes their clothing and gives it to the 30 guys who won the bet. Now, you know, if I ever get around to writing my Dick Move God coffee table book, these two stories are going to be in it. Can you imagine Jesus having made some stupid bet with these people and then when they won, murdering people to take their crap and giving it to the guys who won? No, you can't imagine Jesus having done that. Well, if Jesus wouldn't have done that, and if God is just like Jesus, then God didn't do that. I'm sorry. These things either didn't happen, or if they did happen, God was nowhere to be found. His fingerprints are like not on the scene at all. He's got nothing to do with this. And so I would recommend Brad Jurczak's book, A More Christ-Like God, to you. And on the show this week, we're going to have Jared Bias, who co-hosts a podcast with Peter Enns called The Bible for Normal People. Peter Enns, if you're not familiar with him, he is an Old Testament theologian and used to teach at Westminster in Philadelphia. He wrote books like The Sin of Certainty, The Bible Told Me So, and on a more academic level, Inspiration and Incarnation. And we're going to talk to Jared, who co-hosts For Normal People with Pete, about some of these similar themes about problematic Old Testament texts, especially violent ones. You know, all ancient Near Eastern origin myths were designed to contextualize and legitimize the myth tellers, right? And so how do we understand these stories in the Old Testament? You know, stories about Israel, whether it's creation accounts or whether it's the Exodus and the origin of the nation as such. How are we to understand these things? Well, I would suggest, and I talk a little bit about this in Misfit Faith in my book, but I would suggest that one of the things we need to understand is that there's a difference between narrative discourse and scientific discourse, okay? Narrative discourse, the purpose of that is to kind of situate a people in a context by means of a story, right? And so, you know, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, right? There's a historical prologue to the Mosaic covenant. And so often in the ancient Near East, in antiquity, with these different kinds of people in the region around Mesopotamia, Israel included, you've got these stories that are designed to sort of legitimize a people, to say, this is who we are. This is how we understand ourselves. This is where we came from. This is how we got here. In the same way that if someone comes up to me and introduce themselves and I introduce myself to them, I'm going to say things like, hey, my name's Jason. I come from California. I've got a younger brother. You know, I used to live in Europe, whatever. I'm going to tell a story about who I am. Right? I'm not going to give a scientific lecture about how I have cells and bones and a respiratory and central nervous system and all of this kind of thing. Well, that is how the Old Testament often works. You know, back in the old timey days, you know, there really wasn't any kind of scientific discourse, right? They didn't do science the way we do science today. And history wasn't written with the goal of setting forth what really happened, you know, quote unquote. That's just not the way historiography worked. It's not the way people thought in a pre-modern time. And so there's a bit of irony here, you know, because a lot of times people will appeal to the Bible and the historical record, say, in the book of Genesis, for example. They'll appeal to that to legitimize the Bible. And there are others who will appeal to the Genesis record to criticize the Bible. But the irony here is that oftentimes both people, the critic and the apologist, are coming to the text with the same kind of modern assumptions, right? And so therefore, they're both just either religious or secular fundamentalists. They both have the same hermeneutic. They both have the same interpretive assumptions, namely that the Bible is a kind of scientific textbook, right? And it's meant to be taken literally, and it's meant to play by all the rules of modern post-Enlightenment historiography. But of course, that is an assumption that we ought to question. How are we to approach biblical history, especially the violent kind? Well, one of the things that they say, Jared and Pete, on the Bible for Normal People podcast is this, and I think it's very, very helpful. The principle is this, that God lets his people tell the story. God lets his people tell their own story. And so this means that often an Old Testament writer will give an account that's consistent with the way ancient Near Eastern writers would tell stories in antiquity, right? And so they'll attribute all kinds of stuff to God or the gods, whether it's the vanquishing of a foreign host or stopping the mouths of lions or a flood or whatever it might be. And so the question, you know, did it really happen that way, was sort of irrelevant. You know, that's not the point. The point is not that I'm reconstructing with perfect scientific accuracy the events that happened 2,000 years ago. The point is that this is how we understand ourselves. This is where we came from. This is how we legitimize and contextualize and situate ourselves, our people, in this world. And so, in many ways, what the Old Testament does is it tells us more about the people who wrote it than it does about what God allegedly did or did not do, and that is okay. And so I'm going to see if I can get Jared on the phone. Jared Bias is a writer. I know he's a former pastor and professor. I'm not sure if he is still doing those things or not. He is certainly a theologian and a podcaster, and so hang on a second. I'm going to get Jared on the phone.
Hello?
Hey, I'm trying to reach Jared Bias.
This is him.
Hey, man, I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us tonight.
Absolutely.
So I'm a big fan of your podcast that you do with Pete Enns, The Bible for Normal People, and I'd recommend that to everyone listening to this. And we began a series on Scripture just last week, and so I thought you'd be a perfect guest to have on. Now, the first thing I wanted to ask you is, you know, without getting into specifics, which we can do in a minute, but what are some good or bad ways that we might respond to these violent portrayals of God in the Old Testament?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in some ways, I would want to resist that idea of good or bad and want to ask the question. I'm a student of philosophy, so I want to answer a lot of questions with questions, but yeah, you know, good or bad. I think a lot of people are just trying to wrestle with it and doing the best that they can with the tools that they have. So, you know, there's been a lot of different ways that people throughout church history have tried to manage these texts. And you know, one of those is taking the whole thing metaphorical in some sense, or the church fathers might say there's a spiritual reading to it. So the real meaning behind it isn't the literal history of what happened, but there's a spiritual meaning behind it. Whether that's that God will vanquish your spiritual foes, and so that's one way that people have. I think that's a way that we might call bad today, because it doesn't really doesn't have a lot of purchasing power for us. But another way is a way that I would kind of shy away from. Leans heavily on, I think it's Isaiah 55 that says, you know, God's ways are not our ways. His ways are higher than ours. Kind of as a way of saying, hey, yeah, this happened and we can't make a lot of sense of it, but hey, God knows what God is doing. And so if God says it's just that all these genocidal things happen, then it must be just. And, you know, you get yourself into a little bit of a logical knot if you go that direction, because you have to sort of ask the question, okay, so is genocide just? Well, when God does it, it's just, is usually the response. But then you kind of come into the New Testament where Jesus says things like, you know, be perfect, just like your Father in heaven is perfect. And there's the sense that we're supposed to be imitating God. And so then we have to figure out, we're kind of back at square one. Well, when do we imitate God or when do we not? So it didn't really answer the question to just pass it off and say that God's ways are higher than ours. You still end up back where you started. So those tend not to be that helpful of a solution. But, you know, one thing I would say is a better way of looking at it too is understanding the context that these passages are in and how the ancients would have talked about things like this. You know, it's really interesting that the Canaanite genocide, for instance, was supposed to be complete and absolute. You know, you should decimate and destroy all men, women, and children, and even cattle and all these things. And then, you know, not even a few chapters later, you get that there are still Canaanites in the land. So it's like, wait, what happened? They didn't actually follow through with that. And that points a little bit to the hyperbole or the exaggeration that we often find in the Bible. And I wouldn't say that that's bad of the Bible. I think it's what you would expect in an ancient text. If we read other texts of conquests, they would say the same thing. And there's, I think, one text that we know of from a foreign enemy of Israel that says they vanquished Israel off the face of the earth. And we know that's not true, but that's how you communicate these things. So understanding the context helps that. And then, you know, ultimately, I think one of the best ways would be to actually, you have to go back to asking, what is the Bible? And what do we do with it to really to grapple with those? Because I think you run into a lot of problems if you continue to say that the Bible is sort of God's word in some dictatorial way and that God sanctioned this genocide. I think you just end up in some knots there.
Yeah, well, you guys have talked on your show about this idea that God lets his people tell their story. And I find that very helpful. And I was wondering if you might kind of unpack that a little bit for our audience. You know, when we look at these, especially the conquest narratives that you mentioned, you know, and we see this sometimes hyperbolic, almost chest-thumping passages that talk about Israel's genesis and their conquest of the land. What does it mean when we say that God, in some sense, lets his own children or lets his own people tell their story?
I think one thing that when we talk about that on the podcast and elsewhere, I think we at root just mean that everything, well, I'll say it this way, for me, everything is interpretation. And so every time we have something written down, it's an interpretation of what we might say is an event or an experience. And that's, you know, that's kind of written into what it means to talk and communicate and write things down. And so we would expect this even more. You know, one of the good examples, and Peter Enns, my co-host on the podcast, talks about this in his book, Inspiration and Incarnation, is we would expect the kind of God who sends, who sends Jesus and incarnates himself into the muck and messiness of everyday human life. If that God were to write a book, it probably would be looking pretty much the same as Jesus in the muck and messiness of everyday life. And you know, that kind of is the book that we have. And so, you know, that God lets the people write the story, it is theology. I mean, that's what theology is trying to interpret what God is doing in the world right now through the lens of what we have available to us, which is, what was God doing back then? What do we think God might be doing in the future? What's our own personal experience? And we write the story that way. And God seems to be pretty okay with that, if the Bible is any indication.
Yeah, it's almost as though the incarnation of the Son is some sort of metaphor for how we're to understand the written word. I mean, who'd have thought, right?
Right, exactly.
you know, you think about Jesus himself, and, you know, it's so easy these days to forget that he was human. And we often, you know, emphasize his divinity to the point where we almost think of him as this guru who floats above the earth and doesn't leave footprints when he walks down the beach in Galilee. You know, and I think we often treat the Bible in the same way, where we become almost offended at its humanity. We become offended sometimes at the idea that it is a human book that reflects its human authors, similarly to how the earliest heretics denied not so much the divinity, but the humanity of Christ, right?
Yeah. And you know, that's a great point, Jason, about it reminds me of this passage. So there's a 19th century philosopher that I love named Soren Kierkegaard. And he has this great passage in one of his books where he says, you know, I'm really grateful. A lot of people I run into say, man, if I could only go back to the time of Jesus, I would love it. And I would love to see all the miracles. And he says, I'm actually really glad that I'm not back there because I probably would have missed him. I probably wouldn't have actually believed that this guy was the Son of God. And I think that's how, you know, kind of what you say. And I think we do that with the Bible, where it's like, well, if we could just go back then and see God on Mount Sinai, or the revelation of God on Zion, and these miraculous things happening. But if we look into the Bible, we actually realize that that people were missing it, that God wasn't, that these things didn't happen every day. They very rarely happen. And even then, they could be misinterpreted. You know, I think of, I think it's, who was it, that Elijah, who's looking for God in the thunder, looking for God. And really what that is, one writer, John Levinson, will say, it sounds to me like Elijah's looking for God in the way that God revealed himself to Moses. And God didn't reveal himself in that way. And so, you know, Elijah's kind of missing it until he finally hears God in the still small voice. And so, yeah, I think we put a lot of emphasis. We, you know, Sunday school doesn't help this, where we think, if we could just go back, we would see miracles every day, and we wouldn't have to have faith because it would all just be evident right there in front of us. And that just actually isn't the case. And I think that the same is true for the Bible, and the same is true for Jesus.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a delusion, really. I mean, if I were to go back to the time of Christ, more than just missing him, I probably would have killed him.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what the Gospels are really trying to say. I mean, the people closest to him are the people who denied him, the people who, you know, it's the religious folks who killed him. And there is some parallels there with the Bible. And I think our need for certainty and to feel certain has made an idol of Jesus, of the Bible, of God, to fill this need that we have.
Yeah, no doubt. Now, if we're going to take an alternative approach, you know, I spoke last week with Brad Jersak, and we talked about his thesis, you know, that God is just like Jesus, and, you know, especially Jesus as he empties himself out and suffers on the cross. If we were to take this approach and apply it to something like, we already talked a little bit about the Canaanite genocide, but there's also the Noahic flood, you know, where allegedly the flood was worldwide and God was so sick and tired of humanity, and so he kills everybody except 8 people. You know, how might we approach these particular texts and read them in a less violent manner?
Well, you know, where I think I might differ, and I will just humbly say here that I'm not in the same league maybe as a Brad Jersak or Brian Zond or Peter Enns in these discussions, but you know, one of the things that I would hesitate to do is to be so quick to try and read it in a nonviolent way. In some ways, I think that does, no pun intended, but I think that does violence to the text. Like, let the Bible say what it needs to say. Let's, you know, sometimes I think we can sort of be embarrassed about some of these passages because we don't know what to do with them. And so the first thing for me is let it settle in that this is in our Bible. We have genocide. We have God-sanctioned genocide. Not only through people, but in, you know, you mentioned in the early chapters of Genesis, at the very beginning, God not only sanctions it, but does it himself. And we have to really wrestle with that. And I think sometimes, you know, we can really quickly rush to the New Testament and then say, oh, good, now I can just ignore everything else. And so, you know, I would want to be careful not to do that. And because when we sit with it, we can also start to understand, again, the theology behind it. And I would want to understand, before I started putting Jesus back onto some of these passages and saying, okay, well, this is how God really is, and so we can just ignore, you know, how this works, or have some mechanism to undermine that text, I would want to understand why is it in there in the first place? And you know, so for me, it would be, for instance, with Noah and the flood, it's understanding the way the culture would have written at the time. There were other flood stories, and understanding not why is there a flood story in our Bible, but why this flood story? It is different than the other flood stories that we find in nearby cultures. So, and when we do that, we understand, for instance, that in other flood stories, the reason that God is going to wipe everyone out, or the gods are going to wipe everyone out, is, you know, they're being too loud and people are just annoying. And why did we even create people? They were not the help that they were supposed to do. They were created to, in the creation stories that we have, like Enuma Elish, they're created to help us do all the work that we don't want to do as gods. So they're basically slaves. And, you know, if slaves get annoying, we should just wipe them out. They're getting too loud down there. I'm trying to sleep up here as a high god. And so for me, I want to understand, well, why did the writers of Genesis change the story? And we see a little bit of the trajectory of the dignity of humanity and this image of God, and that there's something going on here beyond just that people are playthings for the gods, but that they have inherent value, they have inherent dignity. So understanding that, for instance, in the Noah flood, before we jump to the New Testament, and I think there's validity there to reading those texts in a non-violent way, but there's also acknowledging and exploring, I think there's a depth to understanding the Old Testament theology in itself. So.
Yeah, you know, I mean, these old Mesopotamian gods, like, those are the gods I can relate to, because I would absolutely, I mean, I half the time want to wipe out my neighbors for being too loud.
Your neighbors don't listen to this podcast, do they?
Not anymore. Now, as we wrap up, I recently read, I don't know if you've read it, but I recently read the first volume of Greg Boyd's book, his two-volume set about crucifying the warrior god. And he makes an interesting point that it is divine condescension on God's part to allow himself and his own image to be, as it were, altered and smeared by letting the Israelites write these things about him that he never did. And he, of course, draws a perfect line between that and the literal image of Jesus being marred in his crucifixion. And I'm curious, you know, what do you think this approach that you and Pete have talked about on your guys' show, what does this show us about God himself, the fact that he allows his children to tell a story? And what does it mean for how we think about the nature of Scripture itself?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think, you know, one, I would say it raises more questions than it does provides answers, that's for sure. But, you know, one thing I think of is I kind of actually come back to a theology in Genesis around creation, and that we're created in the image of a creative God. And so there is this aspect where we're given creative license to create. And you know, I kind of think of N.T. Wright, I think, who talks about the drama of Scripture, and I think there's maybe several others who've taken that now. Basically, in saying that the story isn't finished, the story's not fully written, and that's really what theology is as we have to write the story, and we have the first and second and third acts, and now things have changed, and we have to reinterpret. And so I think there's something to that understanding of God. And it, you know, when we first started, I talked about good or bad ways of interpreting these violent passages, and I think some of the better ways we can do it really calls into question our understanding of who God is. And when we take seriously the Bible and the messiness of this text, it can't help but call into question some of these ideas that maybe we grew up with about who God is and what this text is about. And it really is a text that calls us to act and behave, and it's a tool rather than an end in itself in a lot of ways. And so it doesn't give us the answers. It gives us footsteps maybe in the right direction, or points us in certain ways. And then we have to do the wrestling. Just like in these texts, things are happening in the world, and we are seeing in the text the Israelite people, or the redactors, the editors during the exile, wrestling with the question of, are we God's people? Why are we in exile? And writing these stories to explain that. And then, you know, after the exile and they're back in the land, and things aren't what they seem to be before, and now we're left wondering, are we still God's people? And what does that mean? And the answers don't come from heaven. They come from a community of people wrestling with these questions together and looking at the texts and the experiences that these older Israelites had of God, their own personal experiences with God, and they're trying to make sense of it. And so for me, what it does is it actually is very liberating once you can get past the fear of, well, maybe this isn't here to give us certainty. Maybe the Bible's here to kind of nudge us toward creativity and wisdom, a life well lived, a life faithful to God. And so I think, you know, I would say in my own reading of the Bible and how my views on God have changed, the idea of wisdom has come to the fore, and it's amazing how much the Bible has to say about wisdom if you have kind of eyes to see it. So,
well, absolutely. And, you know, there, especially in this kind of postmodern culture that we live in, you know, I live in Seattle, you're in Philadelphia, I think, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I mean, there's something about the ambiguity and messiness of it all that makes me trust it. Whereas if it were all perfectly airtight with all the T's crossed and I's dotted and loose ends nicely tied up together, there's something almost counterfeit or untrustworthy or too good to be true about that. Whereas when we do have to wrestle and apply, as you said, wisdom to these passages, there's something comforting in that ambiguity, I think.
Yeah. You know, one example I often give is sort of a parent who never lets their kid fail and never lets their kids struggle versus a parent who allows them to fail, allows them to struggle. And, you know, if you're trying to build strength, the struggle is the process. And so that's my views of God changed in that, you know, a belief that this God is really interested in building character, building critical thinking, building and developing us into mature adults. And we kind of see that at the very beginning in the early chapters of Genesis, that there's a way of reading that text, which I think is more faithful reading, around that it's about development, it's about wisdom, it's about growing up. And that comes from not knowing the answer. It comes from lived experience. And I think the Bible is resisting easy answers and certainty at every turn and forcing us to grow up in I think, helpful ways.
So Jared, tell us as we finish, tell our audience where they can find yours and Pete's podcast, and if there's anything that you're working on of your own, where they can find that or how they can engage with you guys on social media.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find me on Facebook. Just look up my name, Jared Bias. But as far as the podcast and everything we do, you can go to thebiblefornormalpeople.com, where we blog and do a bunch of other things. You can find the podcast there as well. I have a few projects I'm working on books-wise, but as always, those are slow going. So don't have any more information about that yet.
Well, as I said before, thanks very much for giving a bit of your time to us tonight.
Absolutely.
Hey, Jason, this is Michael from Texas. I'll pause and wait for some criticism. Okay, there it is. Good one. Just wanted to know if you would tackle the Christian church billboard sign, or just Christian church sign. That's something where I tend to need a minute when I see an awful church billboard sign. It just makes me think, man, do people actually think that some horribly, not even witty thing is going to get people into church? And thinking, you know what? Yeah, I should go there. That sounds great. I'm not sure if you want to make that a part of your daily dread or whatnot, or even, comment on that. But that's just something, whenever I drive by something, it just really chaps my hide. All right, thanks for everything, and I'll let you do. And out. Bye.
All right. Thank you, Michael from Texas, for the question. Dude, church marquees just crack me up. You know, I would love to. I mean, part of me is like really glad I'm not a pastor anymore. I have talked about how I miss, you know, the speaking and the teaching and that part of it. But I actually would absolutely be a pastor again if I could be in charge of the church's marquee. You know, the sign out on the road that advertises the whatever the, you know, sermon series that I'm doing or whatever. I would totally take that job if I could be in charge of that marquee, only for the purposes of like irony and trolling. You know, like we could do a series of sermons comparing the various Christian traditions, and each week, you know, our billboard would say things like Pentecostals do it with tongues, or, you know, Presbyterians do it decently and in order, or whatever. Or even better, I would love to say the most like suggestive stuff ever, and act like I had no idea. You know, I'm acting like so innocent that I had no idea that there was any kind of like innuendo or sexual undertones at all in what I put on the billboard, you know. So ones that say, in your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore, you know, or before you can be on top, you have to spend time on your knees, or you can't enter heaven unless Jesus enters you. Right, I would absolutely put that stuff on a billboard, and then just completely put my hands in the air in utter innocence if I'm ever called on it. The best, though, is I saw this series of church signs in a town where there was like a Catholic church and a Presbyterian church, and they're having this like church sign battle. You know, and it's almost like a rap battle. You know, it's like Eminem doing some rap battle in 8 Mile. You know, I've got in front of me. I'm going to read them to you. Our Lady of Martyrs Catholic Church. They put a thing on their marquee that says all dogs go to heaven. Don't ask me why. And the Presbyterian Church down the road had their sign read, only humans go to heaven. Read the Bible. Okay, and then the Catholic Church's sign, they changed their sign to say, God loves all his creatures, dogs included. And to which the Presbyterian Church responded on their church marquee, dogs don't have souls, this is not open for debate. So the Catholics responded and said, Catholic dogs go to heaven, Presbyterian dogs can talk to their pastor. And the Presbyterian Church responded and said, converting to Catholicism does not magically grant your dog a soul. And so the Catholic Church responded and said, free dog souls with conversion. And then the Presbyterians said, dogs are animals. There aren't any rocks in heaven either. To which the Catholic Church responded on their sign, all rocks go to heaven. That's probably my favorite series of church signs. But to answer your question, I mean, no. I mean, church signs, no one goes to church because of the sign. What they are ways to sort of entertain aging baby boomers who think this kind of thing is just hilarious. But I suppose if you could do it with a little bit of irony and a little bit of sarcasm, then at least there would be that. But thanks, Michael, for the question. Now, we're just about out of time, but before I let you go, I just need a minute.
Now, it's time for Jason Needs a Minute.
You know that thing of when you stay in a hotel and they have those shower spigots that are like the size of a manhole cover and they point straight down? I hate that. Why is this appealing to anyone? When the water is shooting like vertically down, you can't really stand under it because the water's hitting the top of your head and you can't see or even breathe for that matter. I'm sorry, but when I'm having a shower, I don't want to feel like I'm in Abu Ghraib being waterboarded by Dick Cheney. I need to be able to breathe and see. But when you step outside the vertical stream of water, then you get cold because you're all wet and there's no hot water hitting you. But when there's a nice diagonal stream of water, like in most showers, then you can stand there and let it hit you at shoulder level while keeping your head dry unless you want to duck it in there, right? Which would seem to help a lot of women who sometimes like to take a shower without washing their hair or getting it wet, which these vertical shower spigots make impossible, right? So just stop it, science. We don't need this, okay? If you're so bored and haven't got anything to do, then go invent those hovercrafts all those 80s movies promised us.
This has been Jason Needs a Minute.
All right, to play us out, as I said, I've just finished watching The Vanishing of Sidney Hall, and the final song that played as the credits rolled is a song by Bob Dylan called Tomorrow is a Long Time. Now, I have a weird kind of, you know, tricky relationship with Bob Dylan because, like other singer-songwriters, Connor Oberst of Bright Eyes, for example, Dave Matthews and Damien Rice, and even Colin Molloy from the Decemberists, you know, it's like for every one song of theirs that I like, there's 10 that I absolutely hate. And that's the case with Dylan. And so I've never really kind of jumped into the deep end of you know, Bob Dylan's discography, simply because the more crap you add to it, like electronic instruments or percussion or whatever, the less likely I'm going to like it, you know? And so that's why I'm only really drawn to the earliest stuff when it's just him on his guitar with his harmonica. But this is one of those songs, and I don't think I've ever heard it before until I heard it just the other night. And so I'm going to play us out with a snippet of Bob Dylan singing Tomorrow is a Long Time. Thanks for listening, everybody. Talk to you next week.
If today was not a crooked highway, if tonight was not a crooked trail, if tomorrow wasn't such a long time, then lonesome would mean nothing to you at all. Isn't only if my own true love was waiting, if I could hear her heart is softly pounding, isn't only if she was lying by me, that I'd lie in my bed once again.